When people talk about the birth of our nation, Joseph Priestley is one of the most important figures whose name never comes up. And yet, his name appears numerous times in the late correspondence between Adams and Jefferson. Priestley's works spurred scientific discovery, religious controversy, and even political unrest, and he's at the center of Stephen Johnson's latest book, The Invention of Air, A Story of Science, Faith, Revolution, and the Birth of America. It's published by Riverhead Books, and I'm pleased that it has brought Mr. Johnson back to the show. Hi.
It's great to be back.
Now, I've always associated J.B. Priestley with just one thing, oxygen. But your subtitle suggests that there's a lot more of his story than just that.
Exactly. Yeah, it's funny. He is most famous for isolating and discovering oxygen for the first time, but it's a strange thing because, in fact, he wasn't technically the first person to do it. He was the first person to kind of publish his findings. And when he did it, he actually kind of got it wrong in some kind of fundamental ways. And so it's strange that he's kind of entered the pantheon for this discovery. I think he deserves much more credit for a couple of other discoveries he had, and in general for the wide range of his influence, and particularly his influence on the American founding fathers, on Jefferson and Franklin and Adams. And so that's what I really wanted to kind of bring to life with this book.
Well, he was in England. He did come to the new United States at the end of his life, but his influence was through Americans who were in England or through all the books he wrote? He wrote nearly 500 books.
Yeah, he's enormously prolific. I mean, one of the things you really feel when you write a book about him is just you have this moment where you think, God, what have I done with my life compared to this guy? I mean, he just did so many things in so many different fields, which is one of the amazing things.
Were they all interrelated, his interest in religion, science, philosophy, politics?
Yeah, and I think that is one of the important messages that I think is really relevant for us today. And because he was like Jefferson and Franklin in particular, in that they believed that all these different disciplines, they believed that science and politics and religion had to be understood as a kind of connected web, and that they weren't something that you could relegate to the specialists and to the scientists, that you had to be versed in all of these things. And if there's a message, a kind of a timely political message to this book, it's that those are the kind of values of the founding fathers. Those are American values in some ways. And Priestley is the great embodiment of all that, even though he was English.
Today we would popularly call him a Renaissance man, but he really is an example of the British Enlightenment?
Yeah, he's an Enlightenment man. And it's important to say Enlightenment because the Renaissance obviously had great innovation and great science for its time, but it also had a different worldview from that of the Enlightenment. And that was, in the Renaissance time, they didn't yet believe in this kind of continual march of progress. That it was much more cyclical in the way that they thought about things. They thought that there was this Renaissance now, but no doubt another Dark Ages was going to come and we lose all this knowledge. And it wasn't really until the Enlightenment that we started to work with this assumption that science was just going to get better and better and technology was going to get better and better. And it was Priestley who helped kind of create that mindset. I mean, he first met Benjamin Franklin in London in a coffee house.
And Benjamin Franklin is another key figure in this book.
Absolutely, absolutely. Really, in some ways, the first half of the book is about this amazing friendship between Priestley and Franklin. And he'd come to Franklin because he had this idea that he wanted to write a book about the history of electricity. And he wanted to tell it as a story of progress, with Franklin as maybe the main protagonist of the story, and really to show to a popular audience, to a lay audience, what extraordinary innovations had happened over the last century, and to lay it out in that kind of narrative form. And in fact, he was the first person who wrote a public account of the classic story of Franklin and the kite. I mean, we know that story now because of Priestley's story that he wrote in 1767.
Didn't Franklin wind up something of a mentor to Priestley?
Yes. In the beginning, Franklin was the first person who kind of suggested to him that not only was he a wonderful writer about science, but he should actually get involved and do his own experiments and publish his own results. And so Franklin kind of encouraged him to do some work on electricity. And then by the time Priestley got into chemistry and started investigating air, he was very much Franklin's peer.
Did they have any major disagreements over science, politics, or religion?
Well, it's interesting. Priestley was a very religious man, although very eclectic for his time. He co-founded the Unitarian Church in England.
Which is probably the least orthodox of all the Christian denominations, but this is at a time when David Hume is being called an atheist.
That's right. So and it got him ultimately in a lot of trouble, which I'm sure we'll turn to. And he once wrote about, and his religious writings had probably the single biggest impact on Jefferson's view of religion of anyone. But he once wrote to Franklin after Franklin was dead that, you know, it was a shame that someone so, you know, intellectually rich and such a wonderful person as Franklin was ultimately a non-believer. And ever the optimist, Priestley was a very optimistic guy, he thought that it was simply because Franklin had not had the time to read the many volumes of religious writings that Priestley had tried to get him to read, which may have been pushing it a little bit.
Do you think that somebody like Priestley or Benjamin Franklin would even be possible today because of our emphasis on specialization?
Well, this book is certainly a celebration of thinking across boundaries.
To the point where the New York Times critic slapped you on your wrist a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, the approach of the book is not trying to just say this is what happened, but also to answer the question of why this happened, why Priestley was capable of thinking across those different disciplines, and why revolutions in science happen. And I think you can't answer those kinds of questions without moving across different disciplines in your approach. You have to understand the economic context of Priestley's era. You have to understand the information networks. You have to understand the energy flows through society. So, I disagree with that criticism of the book, obviously.
Well, they were upset that you wrote about France 300 million years ago. They didn't see how that fit in to J.B. Priestley.
Yeah, but the truth is, one of the things that made these amazing revolutions possible is that it was, in a sense, powered by the Industrial Revolution and by the leisure time that was made possible by the Industrial Revolution. And the Industrial Revolution happened, crucially, because of these coal deposits that were formed 300 million years ago during the Carboniferous Age. And so when you're trying to answer the question of why, you have to be able to tell the full scope of the story. You can't just have it be about a single individual in his life.
This is also a time, because of the Industrial Revolution, when people are patenting things and taking credit for things. Priestley didn't seem to be as concerned as some. Otherwise, we would be drinking Priestley soda rather than Schweppes.
His happiest discovery, as he wrote about it, was that he was the guy who invented soda water, seltzer water. And it's a classic Priestley story where he had gotten a gig as a minister in Leeds, and he wasn't ready to move into the house he was supposed to move into wasn't ready for him, and so he moved into this temporary house, and there was a brewery next door. And, you know, always the inquisitive sort, he went over and started investigating what was going on there. And he noticed there was this kind of interesting haze coming off the vats of beer. And so he asked the proprietor if he could conduct some scientific experiments over their beer. And I love the idea of this strange minister coming over and saying, could I build a little lab here on your beer? And he basically discovered if you poured water back and forth over this, that it would produce carbonated water and it had this delightful fizziness. And so he just never even occurred to him to make a dime off of this. I mean, he published his formula for it and wrote to the British Navy about how he thought it might cure a scurvy, which was entirely false, but it was an interesting theory. And a few years later, Johannes Schweppes actually decided to patent his tonic water, and we're still paying royalties on that to this day.
My guest is Stephen Johnson, whose latest book is The Invention of Air, A Story of Science, Faith, Revolution, and the Birth of America, published by Riverhead Books. Another name that comes up in the story is Lavoisier.
Well, that's
so. Were these people all exchanging ideas across rivers and channels and oceans?
When Priestley isolated oxygen for the first time, he had made some kind of fundamental mistakes about what he'd figured out, and he gave it this very awkward name of deep flasticated air. And he had this kind of fateful dinner in Paris. He traveled over with his kind of patron at the time and had this dinner with Lavoisier, who was his kind of rival as the world's greatest chemist, basically, at that point. And he told Lavoisier everything he'd discovered and delighted him with all these stories. And Lavoisier said, well, that's really interesting, but I think this guy's got it kind of wrong. And so he did a much more precise kind of scientific work in measuring what was happening when something burned, basically, and was able to isolate oxygen and understand it in a clearer way and actually gave it the name. And so really, I think if anybody deserves credit for it, it certainly belongs to both men.
But Priestley seems a bit of a dilettante, and Lavoisier seems to be more like the kind of modern scientist we're used to.
I think we need both kinds. I think that's part of the lesson here, is that Priestley was a great disruptor of existing paradigms. And he was great at kind of blowing up the orthodoxies of the day. But he wasn't the kind of systematic thinker who could go through that rubble and build a kind of a modern systematic science out of it.
He also had a hand in military science innovations. And Lavoisier was interested in that. In fact, he said, it can truth be said that it is to the supplies of saltpeter, something that Priestley got involved with, that North America owes its freedom.
Yeah, in a lot of ways to Lavoisier too, because the chemical revolution that both men had instituted helped Lavoisier build the most advanced gunpowder in the world, the most powerful gunpowder in the world. And one of the reasons that the key reasons that the Americans were losing the Revolutionary War at the beginning was that they just didn't have any powder. And, you know, another example of how flows of energy through society can change things in fundamental ways. When Franklin negotiated the deal to get all this state-of-the-art gunpowder from France, that was one of the, you know, turning points in the history of the birth of this country.
Didn't Priestley support the American Revolution, leading Samuel Johnson to call him an evil man?
Yeah, his work unsettles everything was the quote. And, yeah, he was one of the most vocal supporters of the American Revolution and then of the French Revolution. And that was, along with his religious writings, what ultimately got him into trouble in England.
So he had to flee.
An angry mob literally burned down his house, tried to kill him, and in the Birmingham riots burned a number of houses and churches in the Birmingham area. He never really felt safe again in England, so he emigrated to America. And he was, in that act alone, doing something very important in our history, which was he was our first great scientist exile, coming to this new country to liberate his ideas and his intellectual activities.
It is also ironic that when Thomas Paine came back to America, he was stoned for being an atheist, and here's this guy escaping England for religious freedom in America.
And he thought he was going to just settle down and finally be outside of controversy, but he got pulled back in it again. He in a sense, sided with Jefferson and the Adams-Jefferson controversy during the Alien Sedition Acts during the Adams administration and started writing publicly about it. And so, in fact, when they built the kind of original hit list of people they might want to deport or arrest in the Alien Sedition, under the Alien and Sedition Act, Priestley's name was on that list.
And yet you call him a lost founding father.
Well, because he keeps showing up at all these crucial elements, and he had so much of an impact. And in fact, there's this kind of wonderful story about this letter that Jefferson writes Priestley at the and in the first days of his administration, welcoming him, you know, under the protection of his laws as president. And that becomes central to the Adams-Jefferson letters.
And you say that he influenced Jefferson's ideas about religion. Didn't Jefferson edit his copy of the Bible?
There's this wonderful, famous document, kind of underground document called Jefferson's Bible, where Jefferson edited out all the supernatural elements to just get back to the kind of core message of Christ. And that was a direct remix, basically, of the Bible based on Priestley's book on the corruptions of Christianity.
Now, why do you open the book with a quote from Mike Huckabee, who during a Republican debate shrugged off a question about evolution by saying, "I'm not planning on writing the curriculum for an eighth grade science book. I'm asking for the opportunity to be president of the United States."
I thought that was such a striking line, because what it suggested was this worldview that the role of being president was so separate from an understanding of science and of technology and the advances of those things that one would never actually need to have that kind of expertise to be president. And I think that that's exactly a betrayal of the kinds of values that you see in Priestley and that you see in the founders when you look at them through Priestley's life. So if anything, what I'm trying to do with this book is to remind us that, you know, when we take a stance like that about science, given how many issues that are important, I mean, energy and environment and genomics and all these things, when we take an attitude like that, we're not just being irresponsible. On some level, we're being un-American. We're betraying the values of founders like Jefferson and Franklin and Adams.
Do you feel that Priestley was something of a kindred spirit because he also wrote popular science books?
Well, I feel like I owe a lot to him. I mean, you know, he kind of invented the genre of popular science in a way.
Are they still fun to read?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. It's not as they don't read as popular science books to the modern reader. But he has wonderful descriptions, and his descriptions of his experiments. He's a great describer of his concoctions. And so those were amazing to go through again.
You talk about connective sensibilities of people like Priestley, Franklin, and Jefferson. Do you think the internet is bringing that back at all?
Yeah, I think while you have specialization in science that is a necessary reality, given how advanced science is, you have to specialize on some level. But we are living in a kind of a new enlightenment, in the sense that there's this new kind of amateur culture that's developing on the internet. We have things like open source software that embodies a lot of the free-floating ideas that that Priestley and Franklin were committed to. So I think, you know, I think if Priestley were around, somebody in a review called him kind of an 18th century blogger, and I think that's probably not entirely wrong.
Well, you call him a lost founding father. Do you think that people will start thinking about him in these terms? Because this is really the first time I've ever thought of Joseph Priestley as having much to do about the American Revolution.
Yeah. I hope so. And there seems to be an interesting response to the book. So for a book about 18th century chemistry and politics, it seems to be striking a little bit of a chord. So we'll see how it plays out.
Stephen Johnson will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store at 92 Warren and Greenwich Streets. And I don't know what kind of a feedback you've gotten so far, but this winds up also becoming part of the wars over science and religion that we have been debating in recent years.
Yeah. I mean, it's supposed to be a contribution to that discussion. Hopefully it's about making connections instead of having battles, because that's what Priestley
was about.
But
there were battles during Priestley's time.
Yeah, that's true. But he was constantly trying to avoid them, and he just kept getting sucked into them in this way. So hopefully we can figure out new ways to connect and not just kind of fight with each other about it.
Stephen Johnson, who's also the author of The Ghost Map and other books, the latest, The Invention of Air, A Story of Science, Faith, Revolution, and the Birth of America, published by Riverhead Books. I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Always great to be here.